This is session number 62, recorded on May 12, 2008, and this is Side A, and we're going into the Croker Quadrant, which is known as the Homeopathic Satellite Squared, squared in brackets. Next column is called diquark, the middle column is tetrad, the next column is consciousness, and it's 1945 to 1960, which is replayed from 1972 to 1977, peaking, crystallizing in 1980. So we're into post-oil crisis, the Arab-Israeli War of 1973, and then we start having the oil crunch in 74, 75, 76, so there's kind of a recession going on in the United States, and so the disco song Staying Alive is what has taken over the mood of civilian life, just surviving. All ideals are gone and down the tank, and the implosion of the media environment leads to people starting to think of conspiracies. So this is the Watergate period, or just after Watergate. But the conspiracy is the Dr. Beter story of the Battle of the Harvest Moon, where the Rockefellers have set up, according to Dr. Beter, have set up a secret base on the moon, and they're building a particle beam generator, and the Russians on September 27, 1977, knock it out, therefore allowing the Bolsheviks, the Russian Soviet Union Bolsheviks, to control the world on a deep military level. The secret Skopsy Christian faction that had worked with the Bolsheviks in taking over the Russia in 1917 were secretly taking over and knocking off the Bolsheviks, and they inherited the victory, the Soviet victory of the Battle of the Harvest Moon by 77, 78, 79 period. And that's when the Bolsheviks started using doubles. So you see, Peter Beter is an authority in this section. And then the other authority is Arthur Croker. Croker is the expert on the Android meme, early version of the Android meme, and he is representing and explaining the robotic nature of collective behavior of the life of media consciousness. And Beter is talking about the robotic individuals, what he called organic robotoids. So there's two kinds of robotic behavior, that you could say the chemical body robotic behavior, and then the collective cultural meme level. In other words, media stereotypes have really taken hold here. And the media at this point is only talking to and by itself, for itself. It's no longer of the people, for the people, by the people. Okay, now you have a comment?
Well, so people, where are the people on the sidelines, or just merged with the technology?
They are on the sidelines because the next quadrant is about reappearance. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at this in light of what we said before, the movie is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The novel is Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus Trilogy. The disease is chronic fatigue. The magazine is Gallery Magazine. Gallery Magazine was second-tier magazine, but people like Walter Bowert wrote a lot of stuff for it, conspiracy stuff, post-Watergate stuff, and Playboy and Rolling Stone and Time are just too slick for the gritty, dirty, marginalized flesh environment of this period, 72 to 77. So Gallery Magazine has a certain level of success and symbolic ambience for that period. The chakras are the brow and crown chakras, so you get near the top of the head. The profession is lawyer. The athlete is Jim Brown, a great black football player for Cleveland Browns. And in the do-re-mi-fa-sol scale, we're in the fa point, fa level. The sexuality is joined at the hip. philosophical approaches, critical theory. That's the beginning of what's called now postmodernism. That's the Roland Barthes, Lyotard, Baudrillard, Foucault, Deleuze and Guattari, Virilio, whatever other semioticians they come up with. No, actually, semioticians is in the Thompson quadrant. So post-structuralist, post-structuralist, this is the post-Derrida presentation.
Yeah, this is postmodern.
What?
This is postmodern school.
Well, the postmodern begins with semiology in the previous quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally structuralism and then post-structuralism. But then you have the...
Yeah, what's... define that, structuralism and post-structuralism.
Well, structuralism was founded in the late 19th century, early 20th century by the French writer de Saussure, S-A-U-S-S-U-R-E. And that's starting to look at the structures of language itself. Looking at language as a medium, which was made possible in McLuhan terms, McLuhan would say, because a new language, electricity, had gone around it, making the old chemical body medium of speech something to be analyzed.
But for a couple hundred years, I mean, hundreds of years, we had grammar and...
Right, that's within the medium. Now, structuralism is looking at speech itself as a phenomenon, not the parts of speech, not the visual space order within speech. That's grammar and syntax. This is looking at the act of speech and how it relates across cultures.
And what sort of structure does that have?
Well, you have to read it. That's a big story. Yeah.
Give me the cartoon outlines of what the structure of speech is.
Well, it would look into the root memes, the root questions about what is language, where did it come from, how are the different languages across cultures the same?
It's that's not a new study. I mean, we derive the meaning of words from Latin and from root languages, probably going back to Sanskrit. But that's not what. There's a name for that. I don't know what it is.
It's philology.
Philology.
And
yeah, and etymology. Yeah.
No, this questions that approach.
Oh.
There were two. What was it? There was two terms. I haven't read this lately. It's the synchronous language is made up of the diachronous and the synchronous, or the paradigmatic and the syntagmatic. In other words, these meanings aren't immediately obvious to you. But if you read structuralism, you basically won't understand it. And that's beyond analyzing the roots. So I'd say it's the incomparable.
What is this, a mode of classification that's on
a bigger level?
It's ambiguous, it's not understandable?
Well, it's on a level, it's anthropologically analyzing cultural formation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas etymology is just looking at the content, you could say. Now, McLuhan said structuralism was a necessary result in the 20th century of the electric age. The older media and their structures become visible and are analyzed. The point is, when you read etymology, that's straightforward. It's easy to understand.
Yep.
You start reading structuralism, you're going to find it difficult as an average educated person. That's the complexity and the angle. It's a perceptual shift that you'd have to get used to.
Well, can we, in addition to saying it's difficult, can we say that it's
well, this dialectic. Here's the other one: the langue, L-A-N-G-U-E, versus the parole. Now, those are French terms, but they refer to meanings and how the people use the language, and then how other structures or classes make language. Then I'm not going to get into it. It's a whole level of expertise that would take a long time to get into. I just summarized it, and you didn't know what I was talking about.
Right.
That proves it.
Right. So there's nothing more you can say about what insights are derived or what use it is, or how it allows you to see things in a
Well, I would say in the Thompson quadrant, and that's what we're talking about, semiology, it also includes the structure, or later it gets developed in looking at advertising and fashionable images and movie media. So semiology starts looking at signs, not just in speech, but in mid-20th century media, electric media.
Right.
And that's a beginning of detachment. We'll call it the triad managers, not the tetrad managers, but in the Thompson quadrant, it's the triad managers who are using signs and communication like ad agencies do to manipulate people. And that form of manipulation is what the semiologists claim to be studying, and the later structuralists.
They talk about signs and signals and signifiers and...
Yeah. So the...
lighting signifiers and...
Yeah, and...
One of the things that I don't understand I certainly don't understand postmodern philosophy in any. I've tried to read it. I don't understand it in any depth. But what I do believe that is true about it is that it shows how you can take all of the cultural artifacts of the past, put them in a blender, and you sort of end up with all times present in a big collage, where, you know, the past and present are beginning to lose their significance.
Yeah, their linear significance. The point of my chart is that semiology and postmodernism, as we were laying out in the Coker quadrant, are effects in academia and in writing culture, textbook culture, are the effects of the media environment. It's the media environment that's making people see things like that.
Right.
So in my essay on the history of the five schools of media ecology, I show how McLuhan was a structuralist and then a post-structuralist. He includes all these disciplines. He laid down the patterns that these later post-modernists, like Baudrillard, Lyotard, Deleuze, Guattari, Foucault, Barthes, and others, and Virilio, they were looking at things that McLuhan looked at, but McLuhan included the causes of it. So in terms of causation, all the thinking that goes on in the Coker quadrant and period of the 70s is a product of this satellite squared situation. That's the point. That's my point.
The French postmodernists understand that McLuhan had already laid it out, the causes of it, and so on?
Well, that's where you get into interesting statements. Like Derrida makes a point. In 71, he's at a conference in Montreal, and he singles out McLuhan and says, McLuhan got it backwards. Acoustic space didn't come before visual space. Writing came before acoustic space.
Right.
So he's either being ornery and just a manipian and flipping the trend of McLuhan into a counter-environment, an attempted counter-environment. And you could say Baudrillard did that. They all did that. And Derrida doesn't write much about McLuhan, just that one passing comment. They agreed to drop him, it seemed, or they instinctively dropped him because they didn't want to talk about what they were really influenced by.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to go past him. So my essay, called Literate Aesthetic Cliché Probes, I can't remember the rest of the title. In the Classroom Without Walls, Literate Aesthetic Cliché Probes in the Classroom Without Walls, which is at fivebody.com/project, you can read the essay. I quote all these people and show how their quotes were preceded by quotes in McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan's showing how they would become academically acceptable. I mean, that kind of study, the Coker Quadrant, is a given in universities in the 80s and 90s. It may not be now, but it was. It became the standard program that the conservatives rebelled against, and the liberal, left, radical professors, or whatever they were, humanists, promoted.
Yeah, I'm sure most of your average literate critics probably considered it mental masturbation.
Yeah, but the other school that didn't think that, what are they, the hipper, the trendier, I don't know, they found it appealing because it seemed to talk about the world that the kids were living in.
So So for them, I guess, I suppose it provided some sense of comprehension of the world, but I don't suppose it led to any practical business advice that could be translated into economic or political or any other terms of practicality.
Yeah, no, the neocons won that battle. The conservatives won the... But some people felt that postmodernism, its loose fluidity, fit the neocon economic agenda.
Did it affect other art movements, such as painting or sculpting or...
Well, Baudrillard did, and maybe Lyotard did, but that was just back then. There's so many different forms of painting now that you can't determine who's influencing what.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the last phase, and that's the Android meme phase, with the Android meme replaying the whole situation, making humans think that it's about them, but it's about the Android meme. So for the chemical body, you have panic. And then I have air, you know, the elements,
mm-hmm.
water, fire, air, and earth, and above that, ether. So Croker's in air because we're on the air. It's electric air. It's totally obvious we're on the air in the McLuhan sense. So it's a pun on air. And I was just looking at an article. There's a new term for something that I think it's IBM and Google. I'm not sure, getting together to do what's called cloud computing. Have you heard that phrase, cloud computing?
No.
Just saw it the other day in the news. So I thought, well, that's appropriate. That's further squaring the Android meme. So I've got air in there, so that predicts that's the right element for where computing's going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the music of that period was disco. The
So, and what's that about? That goes beyond the idea of the disco ball.
That's right. Well, the disco ball is the satellite, which was an invisible environment in the previous quadrants. But once it becomes visible in the holopathic satellite squared situation, the figure of the syndrome of the satellite environment starting to become visible is indicated by the signs, the semiology of the disco, where everybody's dancing around the twinkling, sparkling disco ball, right?
Right.
And it's mirroring off like a media dynamic that Robert Anton Wilson refers to as the Hindu vision of each one mirroring each other into infinity.
Oh, yeah.
You know that image?
Yeah.
The jeweled mirrors?
Right.
That sort of...
Diamond, Indra's diamond net or something?
Yeah, and everybody is mirroring each other, right?
Yeah.
Everything is endless infinity. That's kind of approximating the disco ball effect, at least the one that had the little mirrors that reflected and shone out into the
also,
dance floor.
Also, what do we do with our satellites? We bounce radio frequencies off them, which then bounce back down. So what do we do with the disco ball? We bounce light off of it, which then bounces back down and saturates the audience.
Yeah. So the disco trend is an effect of the sensibility in the larger technological environment of the satellite going invisible and being superseded by a holopathic environment. So the hologram, that satellite originally created in the 60s becomes tinier and goes into the holopathic process, which I've explained many times. That's what I mean by squared. And the satellite ball gets tinier and tinier.
Hmm.
Parallel to that is Johnny Rotten and the punk movement, which is the desperation of flesh, panic flesh, sticking needles in itself,
mm-hmm.
forgetting the fashions of proper clothing and wearing garbage bags, which, of course, slips into a fashion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the dialectic between disco and the Johnny Rotten is like my later acronym of AP/AM, Android Meme versus Anthropomorphic Physical, which is the next quadrant, Anthropomorphic Physical. So within the middle column, the artist is, or the Shakespeare play is Hamlet, and Hamlet is known to be indecisive. The artist is the cultural figure of this period where everybody wants to be an artist and tries to be an artist or is forced by the Android Meme to be an artist in figuring out their relationship to the Android meme. And it's a mythic government, not a universal government or solar or world. And mythic means a particular kind of media stage you identify with. Pick the medium of your choice. And in general, though, it's virtual reality. It's anticipating the election of Ronald Reagan, the actor, phatic, waving president. And the dynamics in the vortex in the middle, you have hackers versus yuppies, laser beam versus computer, Los Angeles, which is the modern virtual space, versus Lemuria, and Lemuria is the culture where the king couldn't see anybody blow him. Well, that's like the virtual class in Hollywood. They do focus groups, find out what the people want a movie about, and then they spew it back to them. And the people have no access to the virtual creators of those movies, TV shows, and video games.
Well, then we're all like the king in Lemuria.
Yes.
We think of a movie we want, and all of a sudden it appears, and we don't even know how.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. And, yeah, because he couldn't see who repaired the bridge, the king of Lemuria. All of a sudden, he'd wave his hand after the bridge collapsed, and then it would reappear shortly after. And he thought he created magic. Well, the arrogance of the Hollywood dream machine are like that in terms of how they create the images for young people to swim in. Young people get longer and longer. People live with their parents till they're 40 years old now.
Yeah.
But this is 30 years ago. But the patterns are beginning there. So the on the stage, the computer, the technologies that are fighting on the visible stage is the laser beam, which gets into Dr. Beter's projections of Soviet particle beam warfare. And then you have the computer. That's the beginning of the personal computer. You know, Apple, what's his name, Bill Gates and those guys get going in 76, 77, 78.
Mm-hmm.
And so does Apple. That's when they first start their little factories.
Right.
So the computer is an older environment, and that's on the stage as a figure.
I forgot, was Bill Gates and the Apple guy, were they buddies when they started out in the garage, or were they competitors from the start?
Well, the Apple guys, Steve Jobs, were making inroads in the early computer expos in the 70s, 78, 70, 76, 77.
But in the very beginning, the first PC, was Jobs and Gates, were they, I guess they weren't buddies.
What happened is that Gates found out about the success of Apple in 76, 77. They went to a convention and tried to connect with them, and they didn't connect.
Right.
So then Gates was forced to go off and create his own scene, which is what he did.
Yeah.
And then they both rose together in separate domains, so to speak.
Right. Steve Jobs had a partner, but I can't remember his name now. I think he...
Steve Wozniak.
He, I guess at some point, sold out his part of the company to Steve Jobs.
Yeah, he didn't like the hyper-ruthless competitiveness.
Yeah, but that the fact that they called it Apple shows the merger of software and hardware.
Yeah. So I was going to say something about so you have the hackers versus the yuppies. Laser beam and computer. If you look at the Dobbs formula chart, you'll see in the Ross Perot section, 1977 to 92, you'll see computer and atom bomb versus satellite and laser beam.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the computer laser beam interaction.
Right.
Okay, so mythic government is a virtual government, and that's after the struggles of Watergate. And then after Watergate, the newspapers didn't want any more real scandals because it sort of interrupted the American presidential image. And Nixon resigning was such a scandalous effect on the image of America in the global theater that nobody wanted a president to get nailed like that again, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the Carter-Reagan era, no scandals could get any traction. And that's where we're starting to be in a post-information environment. Any particular information will not get to the core of a scandal that would then stick on the president and form a revolution or a toppling or a coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another aspect of the virtual environment.
Right.
What became known as the virtual reality. This is starting in the Croker quadrant. Now, Croker himself was studying all these people in the 70s and 80s, and the French postmodernists, and so he became a pretty early expert on it before a lot of Americans, and so he put out some really good books in that period.
Did he contribute to the postmodern movement, or was he a critic of it?
He was ambivalent. He was a Canadian. He's a borderline case. He's promoting them, writing about them, but he does it in a very advanced way, which is a little more detached than anybody who was pro or con postmodernism, because he had the McLuhan angle and sophisticated McLuhanism that he didn't identify with it, but he saw the services of postmodernism as well as the disservices, and was indifferent to both.
What were the services and how would he see the services and how would he see the disservices?
Well, one of his books is called Spasm. The next book is called Data Trash. So he saw that it was a post-information environment and that people were working for the machines who were processing information, and he would call anchors of news shows as Android processors.
Mm-hmm.
And spasm is like the result, the reaction of the flesh, the chemical body, to this discarnate environment. The fluctuation between ecstasy and manic depression, or what we now call bipolar, he saw as a normal condition in the citizenry, and you could say maybe that's a disservice. The other disservice was the warehousing of flesh, the marginalization of flesh, plus being put into concentration camps called nations. He does a lot on that.
Right.
The disappearance of memory, social amnesia. The benefits were that it allowed us to bypass all the previous cops.
Yeah.
Hard cops or soft cops in different forms.
What do you, the hard cops and soft cops, what are you talking about there?
Well, you know how in police work there's always a nice cop, and if they get a prisoner or somebody they want to intimidate, the nice cop will talk to him, and all of a sudden the other cop will be mean.
Oh, yeah.
And jump in and then jump back and forth, so the victim gets quite confused.
Right. And
so this quadrant has critical theory, which is what Croker is interested in.
Remember in the album, the music album Spasm, I don't remember who he produced that with, in conjunction with
Steve Gibson,
yeah,
was the musician.
That's not the guy that wrote
no.
Yeah.
I don't think Steve Gibson became a household name in any way.
Yeah. But I remember one of the themes of that was the will to power, we can rebuild you as machine, which is kind of a Nietzsche, I think Nietzsche thought the will to power was more fundamental than the will to live.
Yeah, the disservice was that we had people who would will nothing just so that they could will. So he called it the will to will. That's what flesh was reduced to. And he has a new book out a couple of years ago, which replays all this stuff, and he reemphasizes an appreciation of Nietzsche, Marx, and is it Heidegger? I think it's Heidegger. Nietzsche, Marx, and Heidegger as important thinkers that Croker reflected and built on, with McLuhan added. But Croker always had a gloss of McLuhan was too much of a utopian, which is not an accurate perception of McLuhan, but he took that surface Madison Avenue image and said that he was anti-McLuhan, or anti that aspect of McLuhan, but said that McLuhan was the first to at least confront the simulation, the simulacrum, the Matrix, right?
Yeah. And possibly more than Croker even knew. What do you think? You think McLuhan was more tapped in than Croker even recognized?
Yeah, probably. We talked a lot about that, you know, way back there. So Close Encounters of the Third Kind, okay, that's about encounters with UFOs, but I'm saying that the real unidentified flying object is the android meme. So that's why I stick that in that quadrant rather than in the universal government, which I said dealt with the UFO reality.
Well, I can't quite make that metaphor in my mind, UFO. I have an idea of what a UFO is. I have an idea of what you mean by the android meme. I don't see this exactly the similarity.
Well, in universal government, I have the movies Easy Rider. A UFO, as we have in pop culture, is pretty Easy Rider, right? It goes all over the place.
Yeah.
Warp spasms, hyperspace. Now, the Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that's direct encounter. Now, of course, the android meme is going inside you. The android meme is an invisible environment, and it flies and it receives those that are flown via it. And so one of the phrases of that period is flight capital. Flight capital comes in the 70s as a term referring to the android meme siphoning off O's and 1's and calls them dollars and claims that the wealth is growing. So the pun on flight.
The android meme might be a close encounter of the fourth or fifth kind.
Yeah, what is the third kind? That's actual interaction, right?
Yeah.
Face-to-face.
Yeah.
So the android meme is Facebook. It is MySpace, MySpace. It's going to begin the process of looking more and more like you.
Mm-hmm.
And providing an environment that seems to be you. And it's not noticed this process. So you're actually having a close encounter with the third kind, the dimensions of which you are not recognizing.
Right.
So people, and they're abducted. They're abducted by the android meme.
Right.
And the android meme more and more makes you feel that you're not so, you're not as much abducted. That's the growth of it over the last 30 years.
Right.
It is abducting you still, but in a way that you don't recognize.
So we've talked about this before, but I don't know why the question keeps arising in my mind. How do you distinguish what we're talking about now from Philip K. Dick's philosophy that we live inside of a hologram matrix and we don't know it?
Because he presents, he uses his novels, the hero, or the protagonist, whatever you call the main character, recognizes they're in a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in paranoia at the end.
Right.
Well, the android meme would allow you to recognize that you're in a hologram, and then there'd be another hologram for you to recognize. It just goes like layers of an onion. It never stops.
Mm-hmm.
And more, it makes you think that there is no hologram. And you definitely wouldn't recognize the hologram. So he's one step previous. He's in the Thompson Quadrant, that there is a structure, a theater, that you recognize you're in. There's no theater in the Holyopathic Satellite Squared. It's post-global theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's moving towards you're free of all media.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to handle. So the framework of P.K. Dick's Leviathan, which he says this hologram, personally, he thought, has been going for 2,000 years, right? Since the Holy Roman Empire.
Right.
But that's just one hologram. There are many holograms. And as the person gets used to jumping from one to another, he feels immune.
Mm-hmm.
So you would get too stuck. Probably that's the problem with the Matrix movie. As Baudrillard said, the Matrix movie is a movie that the Matrix would make.
Mm.
Because it's rear-view mirror, and it doesn't show you the full process. So it's one step back. So that's why you have Philip K. Dick movies are popular now, because they're 30 years out of date.
Isn't the android meme the Matrix? So aren't we living in the Matrix that the Matrix made?
No, I use that term so people get a handle on it, but I'm constantly describing the subtleties of the Matrix that movie doesn't offer.
Yeah.
That's why Beaujard would have nothing to do with the parts 2 and 3. He says these guys have no clue about the Matrix. So the movie that comes out as the Matrix and popularizes a certain level of it is along the lines of P.K. Dick.
Right.
It's an old, it's obsolete, so it works.
Right. You recommended, and I watched recently, the
THX 1138.
Yeah, and George Lucas made that in the late 60s, early 70s. And he portrays a world in which humans and machines have merged, in which there's no big brother or ruling class, because the machine is running itself, but everyone's so hypnotized into their sense of personal will has been demolished, and they've just sort of become part of the automaticity. Everyone's become part of the automaticity of the machine, and they've lost their ability to experience personal emotions and personal will. But the android meme that we live in now, that actually isn't what occurred, and possibly because of the fact that the American hologram emphasizes the idea of the inventive individual. I mean, we bring in THX, they didn't bring their history into the Matrix, but we bring all of our history into this Matrix. We bring in all of the individual inventions and creative arts of the past, and they're all banging around, and we all, but to some degree, I think we are all hypnotized, automatized, and numbed. And in the movie THX, the main character, he begins to break out of the hypnosis and realizes that he wants to experience a level of freedom that he can't have inside the Matrix. And so we're all, you know, banging around trying to find that sense of freedom within this android meme Matrix. But it's a lot more. It's certainly a lot more colorful and lively than the way that Lucas portrays the THX 1138.
Yeah, he's describing the '60s when Valium and McLuhan wrote in the '60s that people they need to take drugs, normal pharmaceutical drugs, just to survive, because the real pressures were pretty incomprehensible for people. So he's describing the police state and the TV chemical body reality of that era and projecting it as the future. What you have now is that when the guy escapes, we now have to recognize that the android meme didn't mind him escaping, and more is offering the illusion that you've escaped. That's why the first movie on the chart is The Great Escape, you know, the pun in there.
Mm-hmm.
The complexity of our time, you know, THX is, like you say, very, very pale, very monodimensional, one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
It's just relying on drugs. I mean, that...
It's colorless. Everyone's dressed in white, and everything's painted white.
Yeah, and that would be a vision of the 60s where color TV is making the younger kids want to have more color in their lives, so that they went counterculture and tried to create culture and costumes, and the older parents were straights. That was the straight vision, straight sensibility, you know, the criticism of the straight sensibility exaggerated, as if everybody had become that way. But the service of the android meme is that it allows everybody to create their own little zones, their niche-marketed postmodern mythic stage,
mm-hmm.
the medium of their choice, or a collection of media of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like George Orwell, rather bland, THX 1138,
right.
And it incorporates a little bit of the drugginess of Brave New World, but the seduction of multimedia and Baroque spirals of those is more what McLuhan talks about, and that's more appropriate to describing what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the multivarious joys and splendors of of electronic input haven't been seriously seriously projected as a dystopia. Maybe the Matrix, but that's even limited. I mean, they have a rave scene, but that goes on 24/7 inside the machine world, not in Zion.
Mm-hmm.
That was supposed to portray happy days at Zion, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the...
It seemed like the modus operandi was to create an efficient and friction-free culture as possible, where everyone was encouraged to be the same on one level in a very communistic way, that everyone was encouraged to buy the products that the culture manufactured in a capitalistic way, but it was all being run on automatic, and in fact it never achieved a level of efficiency, because there was a lot of Rube Goldberg type mistakes that kept occurring inside the human / machine matrix world of the THX.
Yeah, the they do talk about it's a place where no one knows who's in charge and no one cares. It sort of implies the machines are working for themselves and the humans are embedded in it. Mm-hmm. But the Android mean makes you feel, and there it was obvious. You just had to wake up a little bit and you could get alienated pretty quickly. But they didn't have the media platforms to leap from that the Android meme starts providing in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Android meme, I'm beginning to think more in terms of, you know, when you talked about it and thought about it over the years, I've always tended to look at it as, look at the disservices of it. The fact that we're being, the human soul is being mechanized or digitized or something. But the Android meme has services too, doesn't it?
Yeah, every medium has services and disservices.
It provides levels of...
Well, it extends your sensory life.
Yeah.
You have new senses and new bodies to play with.
Provides us with new opportunities to learn how to have fun if we know how to surf the new matrix.
Yeah, how to be satisfied with your diversions and digressions.
Yeah.
And distractions.
But then on the collective scale, you know, of course, it all looks pretty dreary.
Well, what is the collective scale? I don't think it is.
Famine, war, people losing their houses, people doing...
You ever gone into a poor region? They have a great time. They are suffering. They got stomach anger, stomach pains. Mm-hmm. But the kids and people live within that situation and enjoy their senses as much as anybody else. They just maybe aren't using the extended senses. But they have got radio and TV. They've got some primitive technologies, electric technologies.
A book that gave me a little insight into that, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, is called Shantaram. It's about a guy who breaks out of prison in Australia, and he was in for drug charges. He was dealing heroin, and he'd been an addict. But he escapes to India, and he ends up living in the slums in India and writing about his experience and his adventures. And the poorest, you know, some of the poorest neighborhoods on the planet, it's not flat-out mass starvation like some places in Africa, but everybody's in cardboard shanties practically, and it's a pretty wild adventure. It's a pretty wild... His experiences and the people there, their lives are very different from mine, but pretty interesting in many ways.
Yeah, they have very active lives. They got different strains and pressures and tensions. Nobody escapes that, no human being. There's just different ratios of it and different exaggerations of the four bodies.
I think the knowledge, you know, the people live more closely with death and an acceptance of the fact that people around them are going to die or they're going to die or whatever, but they don't seem to let that get in the way of their
vigor the vigor of their bodies.
Yeah, right.
That the and of course, just as many people die in the United States or North America, and it's called, you know, death by modern medicine, a million people a year. It's just that we don't think we're going to die.
Yeah, well, yeah, and while we're dying a slow psychological death, many
yeah.
people on Prozac and so on,
and a physical death, the tragedies of medicine, so that for some reason we do not have death enter our lives as obviously as the poorer regions.
Mm.
We don't have chemical body death. The images of chemical body death. We think that we're being helped by what's killing us.
Yeah.
Whereas the poorer regions do not expect to be helped.
Right. So back to Croker and this virtual. So the senses of the, so you know, we're, I guess we're saying that the senses have become virtualized, and we're probably more virtual than the average. The average person still thinks of themselves. So, you know, when you somebody made the point that, you know, regardless of how advanced our technology becomes, we're still the same, basically the same old human being with the same old basic needs, and nothing has changed on that basic level.
That's the chemical body.
Yeah.
But the other bodies have changed the situation. When you say virtualized, I don't want it to mean that it's less real. The senses have been extended so that we have a new level of sensory interaction which cannot be visualized.
Mm-hmm.
You actually can only visualize it by pointing to the machine that you're using, like a television.
But see, that sounds like the same old thing they talked about in the down through the ages when people talked about spirit. It's the thing that can't be visualized, but it's the thing that's real, that's essential, that you need to wake up to.
Yeah, but the imagery of spirits do not apply to the imagery of our new spirits. That's why I have astral body. The astral body to me means the thing that has all the cultures and times and spaces collected in the Akashic records. Now, the Endor meme is more and more providing replays of everything, of all media forms, and we know now, instantly accessible on the Internet, that's what's referred to. And the reason we have Jim Brown in here is that you're bringing in political correctness, the beginning of tribal imagery warfare, where people have to respect the other tribe's image and be careful on the naming the disservices. So Jim Brown, as a black person, black athlete, he also becomes a movie star. Not a big movie star, but he has a career in many movies. He's crossing over from chemical body expertise in sport into TV body skills.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, going back to the earlier stage, let's say the McLuhan stage, when Jimi Hendrix was becoming a star. You know, he knew how to become a star, an electric star, but he didn't know how to manage his business career, and he got ripped off, and he didn't know how to translate into other mediums, so he ended up getting crushed.
Yeah, he couldn't handle his TV body image, TV landscape image. His chemical body was inadequate. His chemical body couldn't deal with the consequences of a new TV body. Or a TV landscape at that point. This is before the digitization, creating bodies. You know what I mean?
Right.
Shrinking the landscapes to body size, body-friendly organs. So, yeah, he was a chemical body bamboozled by the TV landscape.
Mm. And then we move into the 70s, and some artists are beginning to wise up and become their own business. You know, they're becoming their own business. They're becoming business people as well as artists.
Yeah. And they're going into movies.
And going into movies. And
David Bowie, Ringo Starr, a lot of them. Chris Christopherson.
Yeah.
They start mixing up their media.
Right. But see, now, that's not really a replay. And see, if the Akashic Records are records of Like, for instance, I think about that movie, The Great Escape. Well, whereas it was based on a true story, the portrayal of the actors, of the men in the concentration camp was a distortion. It did not reflect the true circumstances of being in a Nazi concentration camp or a German concentration camp. It reflected the imaginary ideal of the arrogant American who could, who was better than everybody else, even under those kind of brutal circumstances. And so that's not the movie wasn't a replay of Akashic Records. It wasn't a replay of real events. It wasn't going into the archives of what happened in a German concentration camp. It was a distortion in the mind of a guy who made a movie and created something that was, it was designed to evoke some sort of confidence in the American moviegoer, but it was a fake confidence. It wasn't real.
You're missing the point about storage. The Akashic Records means that all times and spaces are available. When you die and go to the Akashic Records, you see all the history of experience, human experience, and even the future, supposedly. That is mimed by the digital warehousing. That's the definition I have in the Paranoia magazine article in April 2007. The idea that you can retrieve anything, and especially with YouTube, you can retrieve all kinds of TV shows, right? You can have access to all kinds of previous times.
Right.
I'm talking about the storage aspect of the astral plane, not whether something is replayed and is accurate.
Right.
The Great Escape was probably useful and accurate for people's perceptions of World War II at that period in 63, 64, when the movie came out, but it was not adequate to the changed needs of the people by
It reflected
blow up.
Yeah.
Which comes out 4 years later.
Right.
Blow up meets a different audience. They've been changed. Great Escape is in the radio quadrant.
Right.
Rouge Quadrant, and then Blow Up is in the McLuhan Quadrant.
Actually, it's amazing to think how quickly the image changed in those 4 years.
Yeah. Well, it was cataclysmic because you had the satellite going around the planet, and that made all the previous media go through schizophrenia, panic, hysteria, and paranoia and ecstasy. And note, I say those terms from the five quadrants because the chart is showing how media go through those actions. I mean, there's colossal Baroque confusion and wealth produced under the satellite matrix of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So things are really competing and changing faster and faster in terms of responding. There's more interactiveness. People see a trend faster. Then there's a counter to that trend. Then there's an indifference to both counter and trend, so then a new trend surfaces.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the LaRouche Quadrant, you have the movie The Great Escape, but then you have the book Catch-22, both portrayals of World War II, but extremely different visions. One is almost postmodern, Catch-22.
Yeah.
And The Great Escape is like 50s John Wayne.
Right. The chart is a picture of postmodern times, and the postmodern situation starts around 1960.
Mm-hmm.
They might be arguing, just like they argue over when does the modern era start? Does it start in 1450 or 1492 or 1776? You know, there's different debates. So postmodernism, you know, for the average consumer, doesn't show up till the 90s as a term.
Mm-hmm.
But technically, postmodernism comes in with 1960 and the TV election of Kennedy and Nixon. And then the postmodern assassination, where nobody can figure out who did it.
Right.
And Baudrillard talks about the disappearance of causes and origins in the postmodern situation. Well, that's expressed in the JFK research.
So echoes the mystery body in some way. The fact that the JFK assassination continues to be a mystery and may always be a mystery.
Right. The mystery body is. The mystery landscape is lurking in this period. Now, the factory's got a 50s movie like Great Escape in the same quadrant as Catch-22. Is your postmodern aesthetic. In architecture, they'll have an image from, you know, Victorian England juxtaposed with a modern, more modern 20th century image or style of architecture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're mixing your time spaces. So that's why if you want to consider The Great Escape as not a postmodern phenomenon as a movie, then that fits because it's mixed in with the postmodern aspect, Catch-22.
Mm-hmm. Then why in each of their ways would you ascribe homeopathic radio to The Great Escape and to Catch-22?
Say that again. Why would I describe?
Why would you ascribe? Why do you ascribe them to the radio, homeopathic radio? What's the sensibility in Catch-22 that's homeopathic radio, and what's the sensibility in The Great Escape that's homeopathic radio?
The Catch-22 is the dilemma of flesh inside the discarnate state.
Mm-hmm.
And how is it going to have an escape? Well, the subsequent quadrants show the various forms of escape.
Mm.
The radio environment is the first discarnate environment, collectively. I mean, the telegraph was discarnate, but that was puny compared to the radio. So the discarnate dilemma, the super-angelization of people, begins in the radio era, and The Great Escape and the Catch-22 lay out that problem in terms of literate and kinetic space, or the ratio I have in the far right, the eye and the other senses, or the ear and the other senses.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Escape implies kinetic movement.
Right.
So if you look at the sensory ratios from the first chemical body, on the right you'll see it's visual and kinetic as figure, and the ground is proprioceptive, osmic, and acoustic. Proprioceptive, osmic, acoustic are more describing the discarnate sensory state as opposed to the visual and the kinetic.
Right.
So the Great Escape, so the radio is a discarnate condition, and of course in 1960 under satellite conditions you're replaying the radio meme and it shrunk, so that's why it's homeopathic as part of the global theater hologram.
Right.
It is a constituent of it, the radio part with that ratio of sensibilities.
Right.
The Great Escape is the radio era of hardware wars, in the sense massive numbers of chemical bodies clashing and around the world.
Right.
You know, the huge millions of, what is it, 60 million people die in World War II?
Yeah. Well, The Great Escape, I guess one of the services of it was that it pointed out the fact that the American ingenuity was one thing, was that these guys dug these tunnels and in a heroic attempt to escape, but also that there was, it also had the flavor that there was something noble about fighting that war, which there, you know, after watching the Ken Burns series, I believe that there was a reason to fight that war. But then the Catch-22 is more cynical. It's like the war is coming to an end, and these guys are trying to figure out how to parlay all the resources of that they've developed during World War II into international corporate business structures in order to become wealthy.
Right. The since the American century, that phrase coined by, I think, by the founder of Time and Life magazines, Henry Luce, the American century becomes a fact after World War II. So The Great Escape and its celebration of the American ingenuity is a celebration of the victors of World War II. The cynicism of Catch-22 brings in the ambivalence of Americans in winning World War II, because in retrospect, it didn't matter who won the war. New media complexities and problems made that kind of management, which in the radio quadrant is called world government, ineffectual when it was up against the solar government and the universal government and the mythic government. So remember, all these quadrants are implied and beginning to unravel even in the time of the first, or let's say manifest, in the first quadrant. It's all happening at the same time, but it just gets more pronounced and enunciated as the phases continue, because every one of these quadrants are inside the electric effect, but they're different kinds of surface electric media which have different sensory ratios, creating different kinds of trends and problems. So the cynicism, the postmodern condition, is you're in two places at the same time. Yay, we won the war, but we've got a whole bunch of new series of discarded issues that the war didn't address. And those that the bureaucracy, the world government that took over after World War II, can be occupied by anybody. It's and as I say, it was a combination of the Jesuits, the Freemasons, the Nazis, the Bolsheviks, and the Mossad. So
they were merging into the same room at that point.
Yeah, and they lived in the same room, and they were.
Although I believe you indicated that the Mossad was operating in the interval.
Within the room.
Yeah.
The whole room is in an interval position, and partly sidelined. Remember, tactility is you're everywhere at once. You're here, there, and back and forth, oscillating. I wanted to say that the janitors or retarded people could run the world government. It's just a functionary image repertory, or repertory. Repeating of cliches of national identities. So it's like the Yippies ran a pig for president in 1968, 40 years ago. The role of the image, as McLuhan said, the presidential surrogate is an automated, the automated presidential surrogate is a superlative nobody. All right?
Right.
The automated presidential surrogate is a superlative nobody, and that applies to any country's leaders. So the intelligence agencies were marginalized as you moved into the 50s.
Mm.
Let's end on that point. We've done an hour.
Right. Okay, I'll see you after the break.
Okay.